I'm aware that there are a number of senators on the committee that are here but are not at the table, and so I think that we are going to begin. Somehow the bills disappeared. What's that? And we're looking for that, or otherwise going to have it reprinted. But when we ended the meeting, I think it was about Thursday, must have been over a week ago, there were some companies that had not given their current energy efficiency and conservation reports, and so I'd like to start with that. We'll be starting with Lauren Logtog from Otter Tail Power Company. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lauren Lotog from Otter Tail Power Company.
Well, could you pull a mic closer?
How's that, Senator?
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. Madam Chair and members of the committee.
So now they're bringing him up here.
I was hoping that today we could have we have a conservation specialist, but due to a family situation, she's not able to be here today. So I'm here to come out of the bullpen and bat for her, or come out of the bullpen and pitch for her. I can get my baseball metaphors mixed up. The experiences that I have in energy conservation are varied, although I'm not the conservation person for my company right now, in the early 1980s, I was an energy extension agent for the Energy Extension Service, and I taught energy conservation to folks in all sorts of settings, from community meetings to kitchen meetings. And one of the things I did is I taught builders and contractors how to build what we called super-insulated houses back in the early 80s. And this was the double wall construction house that some of you may recall. And you could build a house, even back in 1981, with double wall construction, you could build it so tight and so well that you could really heat it with two toasters. And you could do that. For a $100,000 house, you would need to spend about $6,000 to $8,000 extra to accomplish that. Not many super insulated houses actually got built. And the best reason for that is if home builders, folks building a home, had an extra $6,000 or $8,000 available in their mortgage, they didn't spend it on energy conservation. They spent it on better fixtures in their bathroom or nicer appliances in their kitchen. So what that suggests is that a lot of what we're talking about today is consumer behavior and consumer choices that sometimes we have influence over, but we certainly don't have control over.
I want to note for the record that we do have a quorum at this point. Continue, Mr. Logtog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Later in my career, when I went to work for the went into the utility business, I was a commercial and industrial energy auditor. So I was the guy who went out and went through business facilities and counted lights and went through heating and ventilation systems, and wrote reports, made recommendations to our customers concerning what they should do to accomplish energy conservation. So I do have a lot of experience in this field, although I have less experience in conservation programs directly and how to manage them. Otter Tail Power's conservation performance, Madam Chair, I'm going to give you the sort of Reader's Digest version today. I'm going to do the background and comments on Senate File 997 all in one presentation, and I'm hoping I won't take any longer doing this than I would have in my previous presentation. From 1995 to 2005, Otter Tail Power was able to achieve an average of 0.66% of sales. And since 1991, our cumulative energy conservation savings are about 1 million megawatt hours. In fact, we had programs starting in 1995 for ground source heat pumps, which have been mentioned here. We've offered rebates for ground source heat pumps for a long time. We have conservation programs that cover really every end use, and we do our conservation programs not just here in Minnesota, but about 45% of our customers are in the Dakotas, and we do the same conservation programs there, and we get reasonably good results. We're not required to do them in the Dakotas, but because they're cost-effective, we do them in the Dakotas. From 1999 through 2006, we did 150 megawatts of demand-side management, and we did 35 megawatts of pure conservation. The total of these together, 185 megawatts, is significantly larger than my company's share of the Big Stone 2 power plant. Our share of that is 115 megawatts. So really what we've been doing over the last 10 years is forestalling the day when we need to build a new base load plant. I think maybe I should try to tackle the question that some people have raised in meetings we've had with legislators and to some degree in committee meetings. A question's been raised about, does conservation displace the need for base load energy? I'm going to answer that from my energy auditing experience and try to make this as easy as possible. The answer is it depends on if conservation is used all the time or if it's used only part of the time. And I'll give you these two examples. The exit lights in the hallway of a commercial building are on 24/7. And that represents what we call a high load factor. That's a 100% load factor use. And in contrast to that, I want you to think about when I go to bed at night at 10:30 or 11, I turn the light on next to my bed and read for a while, and there's an incandescent bulb that I would, it's probably 75 or 100 watts, and that's on for maybe an hour every night. That has a load factor of 1 hour. If I do that every day, that's only 365 hours a year out of a possible 8,760 hours in a year. That has an extremely low load factor. So the question, can conservation replace base load electricity? If all conservation was replacing loads like exit signs or lights in 24-hour grocery stores, the answer would be that, yes, conservation could replace baseload energy, replace the need for baseload energy. But to the degree that you're doing conservation to replace nights on people's bedstands, the answer is an emphatic no. It doesn't come close to replacing baseload energy. In contrast to that, I think we talked about renewable energy. How much credit do we get for wind? What's the load factor for wind? And the answer for that is about 8 to 10%. We get to count with our reliability organization. All the utilities get to count between 8 and 10% of our wind as a load factor toward base load capacity. So in the end, you have a mixture of things. You have renewables. You have conservation. And conservation on the average is probably 30 or 40% capacity. Base load plants are about 90 to 95% capacity factor, because that's when they're available. And then you've got the exit signs in conservation that are 100% capacity factor. So various things provide different results. And so the answer to the question is you need all of these things, but none of them, neither conservation nor renewables, can replace the need for baseload energy. The goal that we've got in the bill before us, Senate File 997, and at this point I'm going to turn my comments to the bill at hand. The goal of 1.5%.
Mr. Logtuck, this may be unfair. I don't know if you've seen the bill yet, have you?
Madam Chair, I was part of a discussion prior to this meeting that Senator Dibble held, where we had a good discussion of the bill and changes that will be made to it. So I will direct my comments to what I think are the amendments to the bill.
So, Senator Dibble, are you okay with Mr. Logtuck preempting you here?
Depends on what he says, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
It's fine.
the goals that are in the bill, as I understand it, remain at 1.5%, and utilities will be held to at least a 1% conservation goal. I can tell you from our experience that that's a very stretching goal, and it's particularly stretching since we've been making goals every year with the Department of Commerce. Our goal in 2006 was 0.62%, and so now we're going to set a goal of 1.5% with a minimum of 1%. That's a lot more conservation than we've been doing. And the only point I want to make is that no one should suggest to you that there's a linear relationship between if you do X amount of conservation and it costs Y, that you can do 2X and it's only going to cost you 2Y. Because in reality, it's going to cost more than that. Now, discussions we've had about the bill in the intervening time has provided flexibility, and there's a section of the bill that provides what we're calling, for convenience sake, we're calling them off-ramps, and Senator Dibble will speak to these more thoroughly later. And those off-ramps do give us some comfort in knowing that as long as we demonstrate that programs are or are not cost-effective, then we're gonna do the best we can to meet our 1% goal. So that's my company's position at this time, is that we think we can do the 1%. And the other kinds of activities that Senator Dibble will introduce in amendment form will help us to get to places we hope beyond 1%. So I hope that's helpful in maybe as we approach the bill. At that point, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Loctug, I want to go back to your earlier comments, and I'm not sure if I got this correct. Did you say that currently your company is doing 0.266% in conservation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're at 0.66%.
0.66,
yes.
Okay.
And that's our average from 1995 through 2005. And actually, I think I got that off a chart that's been made available by the Department of Commerce at these hearings.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you, then, for your comments. Senator Dibble, are you prepared to offer your bill at this point, or should we hear from Deb Sundin from XL Energy?
Why don't we go ahead with Ms. Sundin, because we have a little tweak on one of the amendments
that okay.
you're going to offer. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Senators, I am actually here today to present to you some of the information that was requested from XL Energy.
I believe we were. Just give us your name again for the record.
My name is Deb Sundin, and I am the Director of Business Product Marketing and SIP DSM at XL Energy. Just a little bit of background, I've worked for XL Energy for 27 years. About 20 years of that, I have been involved in one way or another in our conservation energy efficiency programs at Northern States Power Company. I am here today to talk through some of the information that was requested of us. I understand that the bill has gotten forward than from last Thursday, so I propose to make my comments, the presentations here, I propose to go through it fairly quickly. Willing to answer any questions if I miss points of interest that any of the senators might have. And then also, I am, as Lauren Lautaug was, prepared to address the bill from Xcel Energy's standpoint, if that's appropriate at this time.
It certainly is.
Okay. If you take a look at slide 2 and slide 3, we can take a look at those at the same time. They're basically the composition of how our different class of customers use electricity and gas from Xcel Energy. And really our only point in providing these slides is to show you that in customer counts, our residential customers by far and away are our largest group of customers. But when you take a look at their energy use as a class, they only represent about 28% of the electric use on our system. and they are about 50% of our gas use. We use this information to develop our programs, and I'm going to go through our programs very quickly in a couple of slides from now. But one of the things that happens when we go out and do conservation is that because our commercial and industrial customers are such a large usage part of our system, we get about 95% of our achievement from our business customers and about 5% from our residential customers. Spending is a little bit more equivalent in how we spend on the sectors, but we do achieve a lot more from our business customers. Slide four.
You, Madam, or Ms. Sundin, you're saying you achieve more conservation from your business customers,
yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yes, a lot more. About 95% of our gigawatt hour achievements come from business customers. It's a little bit more evenly split on the gas side.
Okay.
The next slide on slide four is basically just a graph of our achievements from 1990 to 2006. We put this in here to show you that Xcel Energy has been involved in energy efficiency and load management for many years. We've been very committed to it, and we've kind of held to high achievements over those years. I just want to point out quickly the 1994-95 peak is what I refer to as our commercial lighting bubble. And people talk about low-hanging fruit. Those were Xcel Energy's low-hanging fruit years. A lot of T12s going to T8s, and it was very cost-effective for business customers. That no longer is available to us, and as you can see, we've kind of flattened out since then. I also wanted to point out in this slide or this graph that our costs for DSM, even though our achievements have been fairly flat over the last 5 years, our costs have slightly gone up. And that is just showing that the conservation that we are getting from customers is a little bit harder to get. We're getting to the harder to the participants that are a little bit harder to get them to participate in our programs. It costs us more in levels of rebates, as well as we provide more services to the customers to encourage their participation. Slide five, I'm just going to quickly go over. There has been discussion throughout the stakeholder process on the effectiveness of load management as a DSM strategy. And so we put this one in here to just demonstrate that on a summer peak day, if we control all our load management customers, it does shave off about the size of a power plant from our use on those days. Very effective for us in the past 10 years. On slide six, that's a similar graph, and it shows our historic gas DSM achievements. And again, we have increased our achievements in the last few years. That's predominantly because we've shifted some focus to our industrial customers on the gas side. In the initial years, we were more focused on small business, residential, and government and schools. But we have been working with our industrial customers, and it is has allowed us to save more energy. On slide seven is just a listing of all our business business programs on the electric and gas side. As part of your packet, I have provided you with, I don't have it myself, but I have provided you with a summary, a little bit lengthier summary of our programs in case you're interested. But we have a fairly significant portfolio of programs. We try to go after every end use we can in a cost-beneficial way, and we try and if we don't have a specific prescriptive program for an end use for a customer, we actually have a very sizable custom program that allows customers to come to us and say, we have a specialized need that we're going to, or a specialized process in which we're going to make more efficient. Can you help us out? And we analyze it on a project-by-project basis, and it's actually grown quite significantly over the years. On the next slide, we have a list of our residential programs. And again, as I said before, we don't get very much of our impact from the residential side, but we really do have a robust program for our residential customers, so if they want to conserve, we have options for them. On slide nine, we were asked to bring some information on our staffing levels for our SIP efforts. And so this slide just basically shows you that we have about 67 full-time equivalents at Xcel Energy working on Minnesota energy efficiency and load management. They come from many different areas, from the different marketing areas, technical areas, our account management staff, our call center staff. But over the years, the company has grown very focused on energy efficiency and load management, and it has become a central focus in our company and part of our day-to-day business. On slide 10, I want to spend a little bit more time on slide 10 and 11 because it gets to the crux of what we're being asked to do through this legislation, and that is to go after some very aggressive energy savings goals on a going-forward basis. What you have in slide 10 is our 2005 and 2006 electric actuals on energy and megawatt savings. Megawatt is demand savings, peak capacity. And we have saved somewhere in the range between 255 and 260 gigawatt hours in the last couple of years. That represents about 0.8 of 1% our sales in those years. In 2007 and 2009, we have a plan that's been approved by the department. And again, we are building up to keep focusing on that 262 gigawatt hour level. And the reason for that is that our most recent IRP plan, our resource planning plan through the Public Utilities Commission, we agreed to some very aggressive goals based on a potential study we did in the mid-2000s. And they average about 262 gigawatt hours per year. Again, that represents about 0.82% of our current sales. When I said that they were aggressive goals, they are aggressive goals for us, and based on the conservation that is available to us to go after in our customer base. The 1% goal, which we actually are committed to trying to achieve, would raise that to 318 gigawatt hours, or an increase of 21%. So it's 21% increase over already aggressive goals, but that's the level we think we can possibly obtain by 2010, and we're hoping that we can figure out how to do that and make that sustainable. The 1.5% would raise us to 477 gigawatt hours per year. That's an 82% increase over what we consider some of the most aggressive goals we can go after. The potential study that we did do in 2003-2004 timeframe does not support that level of goal. But as I've said previously, we are willing to try and really go after the 1% that we believe is written, and I have seen the bill written in the bill, and try and do that. On the gas side, our gas numbers are a little bit, they fluctuate quite a bit, to be honest with you. In the last couple of years, in 2005 and 2006, we've actually been able to save as a percent of retail sales somewhere between 1.2 and 1.5. Part of this reasoning is we've had some very large, as I said before, some very large industrial projects come through that significantly impacted the savings that we saw. On a going forward basis, 2007, 2008, 2009, you see it dropping down to about the 0.8 level. In 2007, we're still floating around the 1% level because we do have a large industrial project coming in the door again this year that we are aware of. In the 08 and 09, it's more of the business as usual, and we've also had to take, in our last plan, we downsize the amount of savings we take for our largest program on the business side, which is boilers. So the what we think we're going to achieve is impacted by that. If you look at the 1% goal, it probably is achievable. You know, we're willing to take a look at it. We're willing to research, do more research in our customer base and figure out how we could actually make that happen on an annual basis. The 1.5% goal may be doable from year to year, but probably not on a sustainable, consistent basis. And with that, I would just like to say that we have been working very hard with Senator Dibble as well as the other stakeholders in this process over the last couple of days on the bill to address the outstanding concerns that Xcel Energy has had with the bill. I believe that with the addendum that is going to be submitted today by Senator Dibble to this bill, Xcel Energy can support it. And We appreciate the work that everybody has done with us, has worked with us to try and make us whole on what our needs are going forward.
Ms. Sundin, you mentioned that your greatest efficiency is with your business customers and that it was less so with your residential customers, but you said there were programs available if customers were interested. Do you do a heavy marketing or outreach to your residential customers to let them know that those energy efficiency programs are available?
Yes, we do some very heavy mass market techniques. With our business customers, at least with our largest business customers, we actually have account management staff that meets with them. Our smaller business customers, we have a telephone staff that works with our customers. On the residential side, because there's so many of them, there's over a million residential customers, really what we can do in marketing is mass marketing techniques. We use bill inserts, we use newsletters, we use TV advertising, and we also leverage our trade. We do not sell the efficient end-use products. So what we do is we work with the contractors and the vendors that actually sell the product and convince them to sell our customers on more efficient options. And so that's how we go at the residential customer.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, following up on that line of questioning, if, say, all your residential homeowners had switched all their lights to low fluorescent bulbs, what would you estimate your savings? Have you done any kind of runs like that, what your savings might be system-wide?
No.
Sundin.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we haven't done that estimate. Residential customers were very supportive of changing over to compact fluorescents. We have advertised and promoted, and actually we sell compact fluorescents off of our website. Since they were 7.5 inches long and mechanical ballasts that were this big and they had very little color rendition that anybody liked, we've been in that. We've been pushing it. A lot of our customers have adopted. I don't have the recent percents on how many customers have them in their homes. There's a lot additional effort we can make in that way. Compact fluorescents are a huge energy savings, and they are a lot off-peak, though, on the residential customer. So as we have focused in the past on working with our resource planning group to defer plants in the future, compact fluorescents are really not the measure that is going to defer plants in the future. It helps, but on-peak, you know, between the hours of noon and 6, usage is actually more powerful tool to us.
Thank you. I guess that's all the questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Dahl has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sundin, on your testimony about the business customers, those in the last couple of years, that's when you started focusing in on the business customers, is that correct? The commercial customers, and that's where you started seeing these gains in the last few years?
On the gas side.
On the gas side?
Yes. We have focused on the business customer on the electric side from the very beginning.
Okay. And Madam Chair, you've got an account executive that works directly with them?
With the largest customers.
Okay. And finally, then, would it be maybe advantageous to work with, instead of a marketing campaign that's print and TV, to work maybe closer with neighborhood captains in the residential sector to get more of that one-on-one, to get directly with the households and residences to start to turn over? Obviously, that's a habit thing as well as a need to be educated. Is that something that's been talked about in your programs?
Ms. Sundin.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we have looked at those types of things, and part of the problem is the cost. Residential programs are not quite as cost-effective as other programs, and if you put a lot of administration cost and program delivery cost into those programs, they become non-cost-effective. So we have to be very careful on the residential side what our costs are. The residential sector is very problematic to us in a way. There's a million customers, and each one of them has a small amount of energy to be saved, very valuable energy, but a small amount per customer. And we have to get at all million of them to try and get that to happen. if you start putting personnel, Xcel Energy employees, or even hiring contractors to go out and work neighborhood by neighborhood or what have you, the cost of the program accelerates, and a lot of times it will accelerate so that it goes out of cost effectiveness. So we're very careful with that balance. We do have a very sizable education program, however, to kind of compensate for that, where we have done different things over history. We've done videos. We've put in the libraries. We have software on our internet site that people can go in and actually do a mini audit of their home and get the ideas right from Xcel Energy there. We have energy audits they can ask for, request, and have done of their homes. There's a lot of ways that if they make themselves known to us that they're interested, we can react and get the help they want. But it is problematic to go after on a person-to-person basis on the residential side just because of the sheer numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sundin. And Senator Dibble, I guess we're ready for your bill now. Senator Dibble, I know you've worked really hard on this bill, and I appreciate the work that you've put in with stakeholders and trying to take people's concerns into consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, everyone has worked very hard on this. The amendment referenced by the previous two testifiers is still being typed. We're always a study in motion around here. If they could capture the energy in this place, you know, maybe we could count that towards the... So, Madam Chair, I'll start off by offering the A6 amendment, and then I have some oral amendments, some little tweaks. I don't know if we want to incorporate those into the A6 amendment. That should be coming around.
Is that possible? We can do that. We're
right.
Just preparing them.
Okay. Is the A6 amendment, has it come around? Do people have it?
We do have the A6 amendment.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes.
All right. So to the A6 amendment, I would like, I'll wait till people grab it here. We're all about trust and disclosure here. So on page 7, line 31, to delete the words "an exit," to delete the words "an existing" and replace them with "a district." And this is an amendment to a section of the bill that actually incorporates the bill that Senator Tomasoni has later on our agenda. So I don't know if you want Mr. Cirkvenic to explain what that bill is. And why I don't even know why we're making this change.
Could you repeat that oral amendment one more time?
Sure. Page 7, line 32, delete the words "an existing" and replace them with "a district." So it would read, refurbish a district heating or cooling system. So expenditures made to refurbish a district heating or cooling system are considered, et cetera. Did you want to hear from Mr. Cirkvenic?
Sure. Mr. Cirkvenic, do you wish to speak to that oral amendment, or is this to the full amendment?
Madam Chair, to the full amendment, I think would be appropriate. The
oral
amendment's a minor suggestion by the Department of Commerce, and basically this provision allows the municipalities of Virginia and Hibbing,
Minnesota. Mr. Cirkvenic, just for the record, give us your name.
Yes, Gary Cirkvenic. I'm representing the Public Utilities of Virginia and Hibbing. And they operate 100-year-old district heating facilities in both towns with a combined 3,600 both residential and commercial customers. This provision allows them to extend a previous program that they could expend SIP money to refurbish their steam lines. Because they're 100-year-old facilities, they're losing roughly 50% in one case of steam heat through the ground, through leaky steam lines. And so the best, most efficient way to preserve energy is to concentrate on repairing those lines. This gives them the ability to do it. The legislature did extend this provision back a few years ago through 2007. We have additional work to do, and we'd appreciate extending it through 2011, and the department supports the provision. And I'd like to thank Senator Dibble for offering this as an amendment to his bill.
All right.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I have two other oral amendments to add to the A6 amendment. Page 8, line 26, delete everything after the word pipelines before the and everything before the period. So delete the words before the distribution of water or gas into electricity.
So on page 8, line 26.
Yes.
Delete everything after pipelines up to the period.
That's right. This makes a change to a provision that was requested by Minnesota Power. We consulted with them, and that made sense to them. And on page 21, line 8, delete the words such measures. Those are the last two words in that line. And then on line 9, delete the word as, the first word in that line. So delete such measures as. Tightens up that language a bit. That's a change made in consultation with the Multifamily Housing Association. They requested that, and it makes sense to me.
You repeat that?
So, Madam Chair, I move the A6 amendment to the A5 delete all amendments.
I'm sorry, your last one, line, page.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was just moving the amendment then. So the last one I had was page 21, lines 8 and 9,
okay.
Delete the phrase such measures as.
So Senator Dibble moves the A6 amendment. Any discussion on that, along with the oral amendments? Seeing none, all in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
All right. And, Madam Chair, I think we have the cost recovery amendment.
So this is the A7 amendment. It is being handed out. Do you wish to start addressing it? Or?
I need to see it. I don't actually have it myself.
Actually, you know, Senator Dibble, you could address your whole bill. This just really puts it in the format the author requests.
All right. So what's your pleasure, Madam Chair? Should I move the A7 amendment? And then do I need to move the delete all amendment once it's amended? Or did we need to actually move the A5 amendment first and then?
Well, actually, I
get
guess.
Get ahead of ourselves?
We haven't had a hearing on this bill yet.
Correct.
So it's all author's amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move the A7 amendment.
Right. I move the A7 amendment, Madam Chair.
Discussion. All those in favor, signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment passes. And then Senator Dibble, the delete all amendment.
All right, Madam Chair, I move the A5 delete all amendment as amended.
Okay. Discussion. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Dibble on the amended delete all amendment.
Great.
Then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Despite the fact that this bill is 21 pages long, it is as simple as I've been describing. Getting skeptical looks from Senator Rest. It really is. It's a few simple ideas. There's a lot of technical language that goes into operationalizing some of those ideas and a number of provisions that have been included in consultation with various stakeholders and interests so that there's some accommodation of those interests and some comfort language.
Senator Dibble, would you move the microphone just so that it is?
Yes, Madam Chair. Or
just, I think, tilt it so it goes more towards your mouth. That's all.
All right. Thank you.
That's good.
Madam Chair, what Senate File 997 does, and it's consistent with a bill that I originally introduced and a bill that that the governor proposed as a separate bill as well as contained in your larger bill, and that would set a 1.5 annual savings goal in energy efficiency or energy conservation for the state, you know, for each utility. And it allows that goal to be reduced to the 1% that was described earlier if, in fact, a utility applies to reduce that goal and has, you know, reasons to request that reduction. Additionally, it's important to note that in no case is a utility can a utility, and this is, and I'm talking about any utilities, investor-owned, cooperatives, munis, pursue these energy efficiency goals if they're not cost-effective, if the cost that it takes to realize those efficiencies, both to themselves and their customers, would exceed the costs that anyone would save. And, of course, also need to be saving energy along the way, and there are a number of tests that are applied to that. The other major part of the bill is to take research and try to apply it, and it works in cooperation with the Department of Commerce to conduct research and put it out into the field. So there are some assessments made to the utilities. The Department of Commerce makes those assessments and then works with in cooperation with the utilities and goes out into the field and attempts to apply those and figure out what sorts of new technologies, new techniques, new applications, rate techniques, et cetera, might make sense to get towards this overarching goal that there is. And then we've talked and we had quite a bit of discussion around decoupling, and that's the whole mechanism to disconnect the amount of energy that is sold from the fixed costs and the profit making, allow utilities to continue to recoup their fixed costs and decouple the amount of energy that they sell from the profits that they're made. The decoupling, of course, as we've talked about, only makes sense in those instances where we're connecting it to or where there exists some fairly aggressive energy conservation goals. Otherwise, it wouldn't make much sense at all. With that, Madam Chair, I think I'd like to invite Sheldon Johnson to the table.
Sheldon Strom.
I know who Sheldon Johnson. I know another Sheldon. I know a number of Sheldons, actually. And he can also speak to some of I've been working very closely with Mr. Strom from the Center for Energy and Efficiency and or Center of
Energy and Environment.
So too many E words in drafting this bill, and he's done quite a bit of the discussion and negotiation with the other stakeholders, and he can speak to some of the overarching goals that we have in the bill, and then I can take us through some of the finer points of the bill, if that's your pleasure.
Welcome, Mr. Strom.
Just to repeat, my name is Sheldon Strom. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment, and very briefly, as Senator Dibble said, the primary purpose of this goal, this bill, is to establish aggressive goals for energy efficiency. The 1.5% goal is a goal that was initially suggested by the governor, and after kind of extensive review of that, the thought was that that was a very appropriate statewide goal for everybody to try and meet, but that utilities on their own would have difficulty meeting a goal that aggressive year after year. That's why the bill has been restructured to have a 1.5% goal and essentially a minimum goal of 1% for utility programs, once again, conditional upon that being cost-effective. If Minnesota meets this goal, by the year 2025, we will reduce our projected electricity use by about 25%. We will also reduce our carbon dioxide emissions by about 25%. So the combination of the increased efficiency goal and the renewable energy standards you recently passed would reduce projected carbon dioxide emissions by about 42% in the year 2025. So energy efficiency is a very big deal, even though 1.5% a year seems small. You add it up each year, it's a very big deal. And as Senator Dipple said, the bill is really including these goals, this decoupling language, and an emphasis on research and learning and doing a better job with these programs. The rest of the bill is mostly strategies to facilitate getting this done. It's providing more resources to the Department of Commerce so they can review all of the utility plans, so they can develop standardized calculation procedures, so they can effectively evaluate real results, make sure that the savings we're counting on are really there. And that's really what the bill does. It brings both municipal utilities and co-ops in line with investor-owned utilities in trying to meet this goal. The penalty for not meeting the goal is simply that there's that somebody would say in an annual report that this utility didn't meet the goal for these reasons. So there's no explicit penalty for not meeting the goal. But in talking to all of our utilities, a lot of them take this seriously. So if there's going to be a goal, they want it to be an achievable goal. And I think you'll see that most of the utilities will say they think they can meet this goal. Great River has said that. Xcel has said that. Otter Tail just said that. But it will require additional programs and additional efforts over what they've previously done. I'd gotten a call that Senator Solon wanted to know if other states had goals like this. I did some checking on that, and it looks like what most states do is what Minnesota's done, is they have spending requirements as the primary means of getting these energy savings. And then after the spending requirements are set, the states have different ways of establishing these goals. Some states have explicit goals. For example, I think Vermont has a savings goal of about 1.7% a year. To put things in context, Minnesota's spending goals of about 1.5% a year are certainly above the national average. I think the national average for states that have these goals, these spending goals, is about 1.2%. Xcel has an obligation to spend 2% of gross revenues, and that puts them almost at the top nationally in terms of spending. A couple of California utilities are spending 3.5%. Some Vermont utilities are spending 3%. So Minnesota, as everybody knows, is already doing quite a bit on energy efficiency. And the idea of this bill is to supplement these spending goals with more explicit conservation goals.
Okay, and Mr. Strum, we do have another handout, too, that does show what some other states are doing in the area of conservation.
Madam Chair, probably the most interesting part of the bill, kind of the heart of the bill, can be found on page 8. Pretty much that entire section there, that whole page, and then a little bit on the next page. And with your indulgence, I may actually read some of it verbatim because it really gets to some of this goal setting and then how folks can reach that goal, and absent reaching the goal, what some of the accommodations are. So it says each individual utility and association shall have an annual energy savings goal equivalent to 1.5% of gross annual retail energy sales, unless modified, and then the modifications are found down in paragraph D. And then that final sentence just says it's a rolling average, and of course it's corrected. It's weather normalized, so that we recognize that weather accounts for a great variation in the kind of energy that the amounts of energy that we use. Paragraph C is a technical, just to allow that the Department of Commerce can receive these filings on a they don't have to receive them all at the same time. They can receive them in kind of big batches and deal with them as they come in, and they have until 2010 to approve them all and get these new goals underway. And then paragraph D is, you know, is the infamous, of course, off-ramp. We love those words, on-ramp, off-ramp, ramp up. In its energy conservation improvement plan filing, the utility or association may request an adjustment based on historical conservation investment experience, customer class makeup, load growth, conservation potential study, or other factors the commissioner determines warrants an adjustment. And then it says, it goes on to say, the commissioner may not approve a plan that provides for an annual savings goal of less than 1%. And then it says, then it goes on to say what sorts of things, and this is, you know, the product of discussion that we've had over the past few days with a number of the committee members as well as the stakeholders. A utility or association may include in its energy conservation plan measures or programs designed to increase the efficiency of the utility system and waste heat recovery converted into electricity that may count as energy savings if the 1% floor has been achieved by other energy savings. So that comes in between the 1% and the 1.5%. Measures or programs must result in increased energy efficiency greater than that which would have occurred through normal maintenance activity. That makes sense. And then there's some definition of waste heat recovery converted into electricity. And, of course, we had, you know, a fairly extensive discussion of that when we were debating the RES bill. Paragraph E just simply says that an energy savings goal is not satisfied by attaining the revenue expenditure requirements of subdivisions 1A and 1B, but only by meeting energy savings goals. And that's getting us away from simply measuring the amount of money that's spent, but getting us towards the 1.5% goal. And then paragraph F demands the cost effectiveness that I mentioned before, so that we're not spending more than would otherwise be saved by the utilities or customers. So an association or utility is not required to make energy conservation investments that are not cost effective, even if the investment is necessary to attain the energy savings goals. For the purposes of this paragraph, in determining cost effectiveness, the Commission shall consider the costs and benefits to ratepayers, the utility, participants, and society. So that's what's known as a total resource test, and it's a well-accepted mechanism that is used in examining utility plans. The cooperatives and the municipalities are not entirely familiar with this because this is a technique and a mechanism that's employed, you know, through the Public Utilities Commission. Most commonly with the investor-owned utilities, and so they're wanting to look at this and think about it and kick it around a little bit more, and I've reassured them that we will do that as this bill, should it move on from here, wind its way through the next set of processes. And then the next is simply the collection of the data and the public reporting, including, I should mention, there's some CO2 reporting in there. You know, so that's kind of the public disclosure piece. And then paragraph H simply asks the commissioner, the Department of Commerce, to report back to the legislature whether the spending requirements continue to make sense. And that is responsive to a request from the administration, who thinks that maintaining any spending requirements probably may not be the best, so that's a compromise position. And so that's the crux of the bill, Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, could you just, for me, give me an example for F where the utility is not required to make energy conservation investments that are not cost effective, even though the investment is necessary to attain the energy savings goal? So I understand it better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That paragraph would allow a utility to come in less than 1%. The language is pretty strong. An association or utility is not required to make energy conservation investments that are not cost effective, even if the investment is necessary to attain the energy savings goals. So in other words, a utility could come in under 1% if they don't attain the cost effectiveness measure. So, you know, if they're spending jillions of dollars but no one's saving, you know, that jillion dollars and more, then, you know, it's not cost effective. So, you know, if a utility were to spend $1,000, but still find that ratepayers are spending, you know, $2,000 more per year on their energy bills, or they still have to go out and build, you know, a ton of new power plants to meet the demand, then, you know, the $1,000 they're spending is not cost effective. Maybe you can help explain some of the.
Certainly, Senator Dahl, members of the committee. This is something that is that the Department of Commerce has been doing for many years, and it can get very confusing. But the gist of it is that there's an assessment of how much energy is being saved at what cost, and what's the total cost of saving that. And the most common way the department looks at it is they look at the wholesale cost of the energy that's being saved and all of the cost, the utility and the participant cost to do that. And then they come up with a benefit-cost ratio for that particular program or technology. And the reason it has to be done by each individual program, as this previous testifier says, it all depends on when you save this energy. If you save it at night, it's not worth as much as if you save it at peak. Well, at any rate, the Department of Commerce uses four tests, the primary one being this, what's called a societal test. But then that is also colored by other tests. For example, if you found that there were huge energy savings potential, but you didn't want to get them in the first year to meet your goal, and it made more sense to string that out over 5 years to reach that goal, this idea of looking at the ratepayer test would tell you, we could get that in the first year, but why spend twice as much money to get it? Let's string it out a little bit. So the combination of all these tests and the previous experience by the Department of Commerce leads to sort of a reasonableness in all of this. I don't know if that answers your question. But.
Yes, it does.
So,
thank you.
For example,
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If a utility spent $1,000 on, you know, encouraging customers to switch out light bulbs and avoided spending, you know, $2,000, then I hate to say this because it gets everyone's hackles up, but if, avoid spending $2,000 on a, well, let's say on a windmill. then there we go. We'll go after Senator Anderson today. We'll go after Senator Senjum. So they spend $1,000 on the light bulb program, but still have to spend $2,000 on the windmill. That's not cost efficient.
Okay. Are you finished with your presentation?
Yes, Madam Chair, unless folks really want to dive into, I mean, there's a few other ideas. I took some quick notes on some of the other stuff that's embedded in the bill. I can go through some of those very quickly. Gas sales that are, you know, the huge gas sales that are made for the purpose of generating electricity are excluded largely from this. That, you know, and it makes sense, you know, gas sales to generate electricity in this huge volume. You can help explain a little bit better why we exclude that. But
just to clarify,
Mr. Strom,
we've got this goal that's a percentage of sales, but the gas utilities pointed out that some of these cases when they're selling gas for generating electricity, they can't really conserve that. So those sales aren't included in their overall gross sales. What that does is it makes their goal, their percentage goal, a little lower. And it's fair. It's the right way to do it. It also excluded are the large customers who are not included in the Conservation Improvement Program. These are very large customers, a large number of them in Minnesota Power Service District. They're excluded from the calculation as well.
Madam Chair, on page 16. Thank you, Madam Chair. Programs that go to serve low-income residents is significantly revamped. Spending requirements, the spending requirements are retained, or actually there are new kind of minimum threshold spending requirements. The reason for this, Madam Chair, this is actually a subject that's been worked on for a number of years, and it comes to fruition in this bill. And it's very, very important, of course, because the benefit to the individual customer is tremendous in low-income programs when you go into these sorts of households and help people figure out how to save significant money on their bills. But as a part of the overall goals, that we're talking about in this bill, it's a very, very tiny part. But it's very important to preserve the low-income programs. So that's that. We can go into some detail with that, although I'm less familiar with this section than I am with others. But that's the low-income program. And then the references to the low-income program in other parts of the existing SIP language are deleted because they all reside there. There's a section on page 10 that has to do with buildings and establishing some goals and some benchmarks. It's some work that's already being done, but it establishes some motivation on the part of the commissioner in conjunction with the utilities to create a number of additional energy-efficient buildings that are benchmarked on a couple of different standards that we have out there, the Energy Star standard and the leadership in environmental and energy design. The commissioner is directed and can assess some dollars from the utilities and directed to work with the utilities to include some tools so that folks can build more energy-efficient buildings. And I just found out that buildings themselves are responsible for like 76% of all electricity that we use, which was very interesting. And, 30 or 40% of the CO2 that we emit. We have a provision on page 11. It's also in another section, too, where other entities can bring forward good ideas and also can work with utilities and the Department of Commerce to implement some of those good ideas. The idea there is the Chamber of Commerce themselves may form a nonprofit entity, and there are a number of other agencies out there. I think Mr. Strom's organization carries out a number of conservation programs, and so other entities are encouraged to bring forward ideas to the Department of Commerce and utilities for conservation programs, plans, ideas, techniques, and the like. And the limits on the dollars that utilities can spend evaluating their conservation programs is eliminated entirely. We don't think they're going to be spending more than 3% on those, but it didn't make sense to limit their ability to evaluate their conservation programs. And I think those are the highlights, Madam Chair.
You may want to address the decoupling.
Oh, thank you. On the decoupling language, I think the major change from the original draft of the bill is that it's permissive 17. Language.
Page 17, if
I'm
people
sorry,
are
excuse me, on page 17,
sure.
Section 5. Again, it's it's it would be a pilot program that would be undertaken by the Public Utilities Commission, and the Public Utilities Commission is directed to develop the standards and the criteria that would be used. It has to be carried forward in conjunction with the energy savings goals. But it's permissive. It's not directive. A utility can opt in to participate in the pilot program. However, it no longer requires the shadowing or the modeling by all the other utilities. Utilities who don't participate in this pilot program don't need to crank out a whole lot of dollars or a whole lot of data that would cost them a lot of effort and money. It is believed that someone out there, someone has articulated that they could probably get the kind of data you know, from the utilities, do some private grant proposal to do the kind of modeling with the other utilities that would help them understand whether or not a decoupling mechanism would work for them.
Okay, do you have any other testifiers?
I don't, unless Ms. Brunsfeld from the Department of Commerce, or excuse me, Brusman would like to come from the Department of Commerce. Did you want to come forward? She's been, Madam Chair, the department and the agency has been working as hard or harder than all the rest of us, and has significant fingerprints all over this bill as well, and I thank her for all of her effort.
Ms. Brisbane.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As Deputy Commissioner said last week, our existing SIP program has really been a very successful program for the last 25 years, but we're very pleased to see that this bill...
Ms. Brisbane, just identify your name for the record, please.
Christy Brisbane from the Department of Commerce. We're very pleased to see that this bill takes our SIP program sort of to that next level and focuses on the results that we're really looking for, which is the energy savings, and puts a strong emphasis on those savings and sets a very aggressive goal to do that. And I think it's important to note, too, that when we're focusing on the achievements in that program, that we've also set up a tool and a mechanism within this bill so that everyone, all utilities, will be counting their savings in the same manner. We'll have a statewide tool that will sort of quantify what the energy savings for particular measures are so that all utilities will be evaluated in a similar fashion. I think that's very important. In addition to that, the research and development that's available through this bill will help us have sort of a statewide focus. And what is that next technology that will provide energy savings opportunities 2 and 5 years down the road? And then finally, that it retains the protection for our low-income programs. I think that those are all very important elements of the bill, and we've been pleased to work with the author to make sure that those things are included.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Senator Sparks.
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Brusman, can you tell me what load management activities would count under the current proposal, if any?
Ms. Brisbane.
Madam Chair and Senator Sparks, the language in this bill retains the 50% load management spending for municipal and cooperative utilities. So those will be able to continue to be shown through the reports that they provide the department, although I think we'll see significant increases on the conservation side of their spending in order to reach the energy savings goals.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Burfson, each utility files a energy conservation improvement plan. Is that plan going to have to change now? Are you going to have to revamp your filings and your plans and your documentation and everything, right?
Madam Chair and
Ms.
Senator
Brisbane.
Rosen. Yeah, that's correct. We will have a significant change in the reporting as we move forward, both in the scheduling of that reporting and then just the information that's provided to make sure that we're getting all of the energy savings data that'll be necessary to evaluate the goal.
Madam Chair, does this
Senator
have a fiscal
Rosen.
Note to it?
I'm sorry, what?
Madam Chair, does this have a fiscal note?
I believe there might be. It does need to go to finance after this committee.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Yeah. There is no appropriation directly out of the general fund, but of course, I don't know if we touched on it, but there are a couple of places where the Department of Commerce makes assessments, you know, against the utilities for the purpose of research and development and a couple of other items. So there is a fiscal note in that sense that we're not making an appropriation, but, you know, the Department of Commerce is increasing its budget, and we have to deal with their budget.
I would draw your attention to page 9, subdivision 1D.
And Madam Chair, as well.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. As well, page 10, lines 19 and 20, $500,000 for the facilities energy efficiency piece. And then there was and there's one other spot.
Page 10, line 2.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Brisbane.
I did prepare a fiscal note in anticipation of the Delete Everything Amendment for the House yesterday, and so I can speak to sort of where we were at as of yesterday. And the technical assistance assessment that the Chair pointed out does allow the Department to assess for the increased costs related to the evaluation, and that will flow through that assessment. So it's not a general fund appropriation, but it's the assessment process that we have in this bill.
No questions?
Good answer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
How much the department, we're just leaving it up to the department to assess the utilities, how much?
Ms. Brisbane.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the bill caps the amount of assessment that we can do for each of three different things, first being the technical assistance. And in the first 2 years, it caps the assessment at $800,000 for technical assistance. We're anticipating staffing change of about $250,000 related to bringing people on board to make sure all of this can happen. In addition to that, under the technical assistance, setting up that tool that I spoke about, it allows us to contract with a third party to set that up. And our initial estimates say that $800,000 should allow us to do that initially. And then the ongoing costs will allow us to maintain that. I think it's important to note here that the utilities have been in the process of evaluating individually all of these things before. And so, in a sense, each of our utilities has paid for them individually. And now we're pulling that all together into one evaluation and assessing out statewide for that. So while it appears on the state books for the first time, a lot of this activity in one form or another has occurred at each utility level prior to this date. And then the other pieces of it is the flow through for the R&D, and that will be, again, that's a $3.6 million cap in this bill, and that's the average of the last 5 years of what our utilities have spent on research and development, all individually before, is $3.6 million. And then the $500,000 for the B3 and Sustainable Building Guidelines is a continuation of an existing assessment, and that remains at the same level.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
That sounds very simplified, and it sounds great now that you've explained that. But, Senator Dibble, was there much discussion with utilities about these costs and these assessments? Was this discussed with the group?
Senator Dibble.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I don't think there was great I don't think there was a lot of antacid that was dropped on this.
There was a lot
you
of
know, I don't think there was a lot of antacid. I don't think there was, yeah, there was, you know.
A lot of antacid.
Yeah.
Tums.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, I did want to just point out to Senator Sparks the load management question on page 6, lines 17 and 18. There is a change to that, but the load management activities continue to be used for to meet 50% of the conservation investment and spending requirements. So what are the utilities on the spending?
On the spending.
What is he talking about?
It's like Christmas. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Just a couple of other quick things that I thought of after the fact here. I wanted just to draw the committee's attention to the definitions on page 3, just for their, just so they're aware how we define energy efficiency up at the top. Means measures or programs that include energy conservation that target consumer behavior, equipment, processes, or devices designed to produce either an absolute decrease in consumption of electric energy or natural gas or a decrease in consumption of electricity or natural gas on a per unit of production basis without a reduction in quality or level of service provided to the energy consumer. So I think that's some of the expansiveness of that definition that people indicated to me they were looking for. And then, of course, there's always a question about gross annual retail energy sales and how that's defined, annual electric sales to all retail customers in a utility or association's service territory, et cetera. And then I also, Madam Chair, wanted to make sure that the committee members were aware that the performance incentives continue to be permitted provided to the utilities. That's on page 13, lines 30 through 33. Granted, they need to be somewhat revised, and that's what this language speaks to, because you know we're kind of changing the program around a little bit. But what that does, you know, currently under the conservation improvement programs, utilities that successfully save energy for customers, you know, they save this much money for customers and for themselves, you know, their you know, unrealized costs or their avoided costs, you know, but if they save this much energy, they get to recover a little bit of that. They get to participate in some of that cost savings to their customers, and so those performance incentives remain in place.
Right, any further questions?
Now I think I'm done.
Okay, thank you. There are some people that wish to speak to this, and I'm not sure if Mr. Grant was going to speak. Okay. Jeff Doherty from CenterPoint Energy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Jeff Doherty. I'm the Director of Regulatory and Legislative Activities for CenterPoint Energy's Minnesota Gas Operations. And included in my responsibilities are managing CenterPoint Energy's conservation program.
Thank you.
We have viewed this initiative as an opportunity for industry advocates and policymakers to achieve energy savings for Minnesotans. As such, we'd like to recognize the efforts of the Department of Commerce, Senator Dibble, and Representative Kalin for bringing this forward. Globally, we support this bill. It places the emphasis on energy savings and removes the financial disincentives for a natural gas utility to conserve energy. Assuming that we achieve a satisfactory decoupling mechanism through the Public Utilities Commission and a financial incentive mechanism that adequately rewards utility for achieving energy savings, we will do all we can to achieve as much energy savings as possible. That said, this effort will require significant cooperation between industry, advocates, and regulatory agencies. The reason for this is that there is going to be a gap between what we have historically been able to identify as energy savings and up to the 1%. As long as there's cooperation of assistance with all the parties, we'll do the best we can to fill in that gap. This gap is present for several reasons. One is that energy use for natural gas technologies available for inclusion in SIP are limited as compared to the number of electric technologies. Second, Minnesota has some of the most stringent energy and building codes in the country, which diminishes the opportunity for the utility to influence a customer decision. And finally, as how we count these energy savings. And what I mean by that is if there's a 20-year-old home out there that has a 60% efficient furnace and we rebate it with a 92% efficient furnace, we're only able to count the energy savings to where our code is. Assuming satisfactory regulatory outcomes and the cooperation exhibited in this effort continues, we'll do all we can to achieve as much energy savings as possible. Again, thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. And the next speaker is Mike Bash.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Bash. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Kinexis Energy in Ramsey, Minnesota. In my free time, I participate with you at the other side of the table. I'm a past city council member and mayor of the city of Long Lake, and I'm currently honored to serve on the Orono School Board right now. But I'm here to talk today to you today about energy. In case you don't know, Kinexis Energy is the third largest electric utility in the state of Minnesota. From a customer standpoint, a little bit smaller than Minnesota Power. We serve seven counties in the northern suburbs, stretching from the Marine on the St. Croix to just outside of St. Cloud. It's about 1,000 square miles. About two-thirds of our energy sales go to residential customers, approximately one-third to commercial and industrial customers. And in the odd way that cooperatives work, we buy all of our power from our subsidiary, Great River Energy. Two things I'd like to share with you today. One is, again, we support the goal of the bill, but the challenge of us as a utility to help make this happen. You, through legislation, have mandated us to be a monopoly, but with the obligation to provide electric service to the people in our service territory whenever they want it. So when they turn on the light, we have the obligation to make sure the electric energy is there. When they turn on their TV, whatever, our obligation is to react to what they want us to do. We are, and again, the reactors. The challenge is that, and so what we've set up a model today with a prior to this, we've said we've got this SIP program, and we're very good at measuring spending, and we comply with the SIP guidelines, and we spend money. And, you know, it's probably not a bad thing when we say, yeah, just spending money isn't a good measure. If we really want to say conservation, let's measure conservation. And by spending money by itself doesn't necessarily prove any conservation, just says we're good at spending money. Now, again, for us, 61% of our SIP spending goes to conservation. The remainder of our SIP spending went to load management and other programs. So when you look at it and say, well, here's the utility that is the provider, but now there is the mandate to conserve, we aren't the doers of conservation. That's our customers. Our customers are the ones that do the conservation. It's not us. That's not our role. The analogy, and again, that's why it's challenging for us. The analogy is we would all agree that it would be great if we could, to help our energy independence, have more fuel-efficient cars. That would help save our oil imports. But imagine that we stepped up and said, well, the best way to do that is to mandate that all gas stations be responsible for improving their customers' fuel efficiency of their cars. Now, we'd sort of look at that and say that's the gas station's role is to provide gas to people when they drive up and sell them gas. And so the challenge for us as a utility is, well, our customer, we have the mandate to provide power. We're not there when our customers are making that decision. When our customer is at Best Buy trying to decide, do I buy that new plasma TV or not? We're not there at their shoulder suggesting whether they purchase that. The challenge becomes when our customer, when their air conditioner breaks, and they're there at Sears to say, okay, here's the least cost air conditioner I can get. And yeah, there's a rebate if I get a more efficient one, but I still got to pull extra couple hundred bucks out of my pocket. Our customer may say, you know, I don't have that couple extra $100. It may be the smart thing to do, but they don't have it today. And that's the challenge that we have as the utility, is we're not there at their shoulder saying, trust us, it's a really smart investment. It's the right thing to do. Buy the higher efficient air conditioner when you're doing it. That's the challenge that we have as the provider to do this versus the doer of the conservation. The second challenge we have in the handout that I gave you, I want to, as you can look at that, this is surveys that we do of our customers as part of the planning that Great River Energy does to determine do they need to build new power plants. And, of course, what you can see here is this is appliance saturation. We do surveys and say, how do you have and how many you have? And, of course, what you can see from our survey in 1997 and our survey in 2005, you can see, for example, on the second line, not surprisingly, there's a growing saturation of home computers. And, of course, we all know the peripherals that go with that. If you look down six or seven lines, you can look at central air conditioning. And you can see, again, from our customers, we went from a saturation of about 60% to 80% from that period of 1997 to 2005. Our customers are making those decisions to use more energy. And, in fact, when we look at the average use of our residential customers from 1994 to 2005, in spite of the millions that we've spent for residential and commercial rebates, in spite of all the Energy Star appliances that they bought, in spite of the compact fluorescent bulbs that we've tried to get them to buy, the average residential usage has gone up 16.5%. Now, that may say that's the sign that we ought to be conserving because our customers are using more, but again, it shows the challenge of having the utility be the driver for this. The other point is, when we look at our SIP spending, and if we take that for what we're able to spend that produces conservation, if we take that on a linear line to say what would it take us to get 1.5%, our rates to our customers would have to go up at least 6%. Again, that's what it costs to deliver those kinds of savings. Now, we really appreciate the Senator Dibble's listening to the cooperatives and our concern about what that could have as we try to achieve these goals. I think, you know, as a citizen of the state, I think they're great. But the challenge that we have as a cooperative is, can we make sure that those are cost effective and don't increase the rates to our customer owners. And so that's one of the concerns we have, and we appreciate the sensitivity to finding ways to make sure that while we want those to be cost-effective, that, again, looking at spending patterns. You heard earlier Excel talking about how the vast majority of their SIP spending comes from commercial and industrial customers. We are the same. 85% of our savings today comes from commercial and industrial customers, only 15% from our residential customers. But for us, our commercial and industrial customers are only a third of our energy sales. So, again, it gets tough to get after those residential customers, those onesies and twosies. It's really tough to get significant savings because they're so hard to reach and they're expensive to reach. So, again, we appreciate the sensitivity to the cost.
Thank
Any
you.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Bash. Senator Alsein.
Thank you. Last week we sat through some testimony from us. I can't remember if it was a city that had their own electric or a small utility. And this guy was telling us how they've worked with the cities to put in LED stoplights, and they're going to look at LED streetlights and all of those kinds of things. I was pretty impressed that this smaller facility was looking at those kinds of measures. But I would like to hear what you think about that. But I would like to say that, you know, when I'm driving my car, I can go to the gas station across the street or around the corner. There's gas stations all over.
That's right. But if all gas stations were mandated to be responsible for improving your energy efficiency, what would any of the local gas stations say? I don't have the answer. It's just an interesting analogy I applaud the efforts, and I see it in the bill that, you know, what can we do to improve housing codes? You know, when the builder is sitting there with the homeowner to say, what's the most cost-effective way to what kind of appliances should we put in this house? What are the other building codes? That's where we can make big improvements, because that's where the energy purchase decisions are being made. And so to the extent that you can find ways where the energy purchase decisions are being made and find ways to improve that, I believe that will make it much more successful in finding real conservation than those of us that are just reacting. Again, we can do it, and, you know, you have the ability to regulate us to do that, and that's fine. But I'm not sure that we're always going to be the most effective people to be doing that.
I think we need to wrap this up. We are going to need to adjourn at 4:45, or we're going to need to recess at 4:45 if we are not finished. So, any other questions or comments?
I know, I'm going to do my bill.
Okay. Senator Dibble, you wish to?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I will say, though, that this bill does allow for, just to respond quickly, it allows for some of the demand side, or in some ways, the supply side efficiencies also be counted, you know, in between the 1.5. So it's not entirely a demand side bill. So I mean, that just needs to be stated for the record. You know, unless there are other questions, Madam Chair, or other testimony, I can move the bill.
Okay. Questions or comments? I know that there are some members that are not here that want to be here for the vote. They should be on the way. Unfortunately, our caucus is called a caucus at 4:45, and so we are going to need to recess for a period of time. I'm waiting for my CA to come back to see if there's room to move some of these bills to Tuesday. Otherwise, we will probably recess until after the conjoint session this evening.
Ooh.
Madam Chair, as people are trickling.
Senator Dibble, you can move your bill.
All right, thank you. I also wanted to mention before I move the bill that I had a brief conversation before the committee started about the issue of establishing some standards for end use, you know, consumer products. And that's a very valid subject. You know, my response, as it has been on a number of bills this year, is we can't live our whole lives inside of one bill. I think that's very worthy. You know, everyone's excited about Australia and their move to ban incandescent light bulbs. I think we should work on some of that stuff as well. And the utilities may have a role there, too. It's all a work in progress. Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 997 as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? Then all those in favor of the motion, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Oh, excellent work. I appreciate it. Is Senator Erickson Ropes here? Let's see if we can quickly do this.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Oh, that doesn't sound simple.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
As you file out, please do so quietly so that we can finish up some work here. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We'll be very quick. This is just a small policy change, and I put this item before you, Senate File 144. You have an amended copy, and I would like to move the delete all amendment.
Okay, where are they?
Utilities against this? Utilities against this?
Okay, Senator Erickson Ropes moves. Oh, I'm sorry. She can't. Is there a member that would like to move the?
I'll move it.
Senator Anderson moves the A2 amendment. Discussion, and this is just to put it in the author's format. So, all those in favor?
Thank you.
Aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I have a bill before you that would give Winona County very limited authority to go ahead and own and operate a wind turbine. And the EDA has been working on this project for quite a long time. We've involved many stakeholders. We have language before you today that's been agreed upon between Xcel and Winona County. I'll kick it off with Ann Morse, who's the environmental specialist for Winona County. She'll tell you her perspective, and then we have Xcel here, and hopefully we'll get this passed very quickly.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Winona County's been working for the last two...
Please identify yourself for the record.
Ann Morse.
Okay.
Winona County. Okay. Winona County's been working for several years on a large utility-scale wind turbine, and we quickly came up against some lack of authority within the law to allow us to do some things as part of that we'd like to do, including bonding. So the initial draft was rather expansive, but in working with the utilities on it, it's been very, very narrowly crafted at this point, just focuses on segments within Chapter 453, allowing us some bonding authority.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we also have a member of Xcel here to speak on the utility's behalf.
Doesn't look like Grania McKiernan.
No, that's quite correct, Madam Chair.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Carl Lehman, not Grania McKiernan, and I'm simply here to say that we have been pleased to work with both Winona County and with Senator Erickson Ropes, and we are in support of this change. Thank you.
Sure they are. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if this amendment just says the county of Winona. How many other counties are looking at something like this? And if other 86 counties start looking at this, should this be a little more broad? And what is the utility companies going to say to other counties? I'm not against this. Senator, I'm just asking.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, thank you very much for the question. I'll have Ann take that question. We have gone around and discussed those things up one side and down the other.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, very good question. In truth, that was the way initially it was presented. It takes a lot of discussion, I think, for everybody to come to agreement on what we are willing to have counties do. Certainly, municipalities have the ability to work with energy and produce energy and sell energy at wholesale. And for our part, we just would like to sell the energy to Xcel Energy at wholesale. We're not interested in selling it at retail or using it. So those are some discussions I think that will be before you soon. At this point, we need this to move forward on our project. We'd like to get it up this year even. I'm not sure that that will happen. But so we were comfortable crafting it as narrowly.
Senator Rosen? Senator Sharon?
Or did you have another? Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. I would like to hear from Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Lehman?
Madam Chairman, Senator Rosen, I think it's drawn narrowly because each county, as the witness has testified, finds itself in a kind of a unique wholesale and retail position. So we're comfortable with it being drawn narrowly. We're also comfortable looking at it in expansion, but in I think it has to be in a specific, almost case-by-case situation.
Senator Sharon.
Could you speak again to the issue about wholesale versus retail sales? I think that is what is important for me to know, that what we're talking about, and is the language in this and other language restrictive enough that it's clear that it's wholesale and not retail?
Ms. Morris.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, it's we were very clear to specify at wholesale rather than at retail here in the bill. Line 116 may not be sold or distributed at retail or provided for end use.
Thank you. I didn't have the amendment, so that's
what I'm saying. Oh, delete all amendments.
The delete all. I didn't see the. I don't see the delete all.
Oh, it's sorry. In your file.
That's okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is one of the things that the Senate File 563 might be able to determine as they start to look at what's going on around the state. You know, if we've got some, you know, counties looking at getting involved as well, that we might want to have you know, look at how that's going to play into the overall development. We'll know more, hopefully, by the end of the year, whether we should be allowing counties to be a player in this or not. And, but I don't see any reason why we can't go forward with this at this point.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to move the bill if there's no further discussion.
And just for clarification, it isn't the Democrats that have the caucus. It's the Republicans that have the caucus.
Oh, we don't.
Senator Anderson moves the bill as amended. It recommends it to pass and be re-referred to state and local government operations and government oversight.
Do we ask for it?
Yes. Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you.
And
my bill's not controversial.
Senator Rosen, did you say that you were going to stay around or you weren't going to stay around?
Oh.
he tried real. We do have caucus. I mean, okay. If you want me to stick around, I can. Senator Jungbauer is still here, too. We're just talking about regions.
Okay. Senator Olsen.
I've got some testifiers that you we could be fast if we could.
Well, let's see how fast you can be.
Thank you.
Just move it.
Well, that was just money. He just wants money, money, money.
Oh, Olsen.
I thought I was going to say, I thought it was the same thing. Oh, so we can finish in 15. Well, maybe 15. Where's your caucus? Is it over in the SLB?
I'm not going to walk over there.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm here today to talk about Senate File 1510. And with me, I've got the Chisago County Commissioner, Mike Robinson, and then Dave Whitney from Citizens Concern for all the group name changed. and then Wade Vitalis, and they're here to speak to this bill.
Okay. Who's first?
Madam Chairman, Senators, I'm Dave Whitney, and this is Wade Vitalis. We're residents of Chisago County, and we're here to encourage you to support this particular bill. Wade and I are not paid employees. And we do this because we think it's we're concerned, interested, and we think it's the right thing to do. 3 years ago, Chisago County was adopting a new comprehensive plan, and landowners were very concerned about a number of issues. And about 450 selected me to represent their ideas before the Planning Commission and the County Board. And at one of the meetings, Commissioner Olsen, who is now Senator Olsen, and I were talking, and at that time Wade was at the same group, if you remember that. And we started talking about the issues that were concerning to all of us, and what we found out was that we had many, many things in common, conservationists and landowners. And over the last 3 years, we've had many, many meetings, and we have found that we have far more things to support than we do that separate us. And therefore, we have the Land Use Coalition. Now, the outcome of this, just for your information, is that the county board unanimously adopted the comprehensive plan, and at the last meeting, there was no one that opposed any part of that particular land use operation. And I think it's because this commissioners heard and responded. This bill is a natural outcome of that particular land use study that was done and accomplished in Chisago. Chisago County area is ideal for this feasibility study. We have 180,000 acres in Chisago alone of 20 acres or more that are undeveloped. Most of this land is marginal for cash crops such as corn and soybeans, but may be very well suited for prairie grass, which can be grown, according to David Tillman, Regents Professor at the university, on soils that have less fertility. Because of the marginal nature of our land, it's easier to convert farmers from corn to a prairie grass product because their profit margins now are so slim. Once farmers see that there is a market for their product and that they can make money raising and harvesting a grass product, they will plant more acres. In addition, the county commissioners recently approved the very progressive comprehensive plan that incorporates transfer of development credits and to create open space and incentives for developers to utilize open space design in new developments. What I'm saying is that we have the land available and the type of soil, according to the leading expert on the subject, needed to potentially harvest large quantities of biomass products, and that we have the comprehensive plan in place to preserve open spaces in the years to come. According to Dr. Tillman, it takes more than an ideal location. Cellulose ethanol is 5+ years from commercial viability because it is much more expensive than corn ethanol. But those who work on this are optimistic that the problem will be solved. Why then a feasibility study now when cellulose may be 5 years off? Cellulose ethanol be 5 years off. According to Dr. Tillman, the second critical issue is creating a marketplace for a biomass product. This problem can be studied and tested and implemented now. Creating a marketplace will take time, and a feasibility study will determine if a market can be developed. Can prairie biogas pellets compete with corn as a burning agent in pellet stoves? Can prairie biomass be profitably used to co-combust with coal in electricity-generated plants? Can prairie biomass pellets be burned in coal ethanol plants rather than burning natural gas? We have the technology now to produce pellets. If any or all of the above can be profitable, we have created an immediate marketplace for prairie biomass, even before it becomes profitable as a source of ethanol. If the feasibility study determines that a market is available, the study needs to also assess whether a statewide carbon credits program would provide the additional incentive and revenue to farmers to profitably increase their acreage in a biomass product. This is my conclusion. The potential benefits to farmers and the environment are overwhelming. Biomass pellets and carbon credits now, ethanol production, cleaner air, and less dependence on oil in the future. At first glance, Chisago, Isani, and Pine counties seem ideal, but this study will determine if we have the land mass, the type of soils, the desire, the vision, and the people necessary to pull this off. I ask you to support this important resolution. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that this bill be accepted and sent on to finance.
Okay. Any questions or comments on the motion? And Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 1510 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank
Senator
you, Madam
Anderson.
Chair.
Thank you.
This is here. I don't see any of my witnesses.
Paula is here.
Oh, they are here. Maybe he'll get here. Did you get a chance to look it over? Yeah, it's, I think this is good. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1244 is a bill. It was heard in another committee, so I do have a delete all amendment I want to offer with some changes we've made. Maybe we should pass that out first, and then I can talk about it before.
We do have that amendment.
Well, I have them. We have a new version of it. It's the A2.
Okay.
There were some things that got left out of the one in your packet, so just ignore that one and
okay.
This one. Thank you. So the A2 amendment is the one I would like to put in front of the committee. Madam Chair, this bill is an effort to try to help us capitalize on the great interest and excitement that we have in producing renewable energy around the state, and a great deal of which we know will be inspired as a result of all of us working to pass the renewable energy standard. We know that we're looking at a multi-billion-dollar industry in the next decade or so in Minnesota, and we've talked a lot about how, in this committee, about how we can try to encourage community-based development of energy and community-based ownership of energy projects so that as much of that investment as possible remains in Minnesota communities and in the Minnesota economy to try to provide economic development, particularly to our rural communities. And so this is an effort to try to provide some help and assistance to people, especially in rural Minnesota, to help them try to put wind projects together and get into the wind development game and hopefully be able to compete more successfully with the huge big companies out there so that they can, you know, the little guys can catch up with the big book guys. And so that's the basic idea here. What we're doing is creating a rural wind assistance project, a program that would be available that would provide technical, legal, financial assistance for individuals that want to try to put a wind development project together. And so the A2 amendment, well, there's two sections, and we add a section and kind of elaborate more than we did. And we started in Senator Metzen's committee talking about economic development, and now what we've changed in the new version is some minor things, but also we fleshed out this revolving loan fund. So that's the piece that's primarily new in the A2 amendment. So what we do is set up a revolving loan fund in the Commerce Department
which would be used to help individuals get access to financing to fund their interconnection studies or their wind studies, which are very costly and hard probably to get traditional financing to borrow money for. And then the rest of the bill relates to the assistance program. And so what we suggest is if I can find some money in my committee to kick this off, we would spin off this program that would put the legal and financial and technical assistance all into one under one roof and help to put deals together and help to kind of aggregate the small proposers together so that they can have better access to wind turbines and, again, to be competitive in this growing and more competitive market. So that's essentially what the bill does. I would like to move the A2 amendment then, if I may, and then let the testifiers talk briefly in support of the bill.
Okay, then Senator Anderson moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Okay. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
I wonder if I could ask a question first of the author. Senator Anderson, you do so much work in this area, and I don't know if this is a silly question or not, but when I began thinking about all of this new wind energy and all of these wind turbines out there in Buffalo Ridge, at what point does the diversion of the wind, what is the magnitude of the diversion of the wind have to be to have an impact on the weather and weather cycles?
You mean how many wind turbines does it take to start to affect wind patterns?
And or, you know,
am I understanding the question?
Yeah, drying conditions. At what, you know.
Okay, I can't really answer that, but maybe one of my witnesses can touch on that.
I don't know whether even a reasonable question or whether wind is always there and it doesn't matter, but it seems to me if we're stopping it and using it, that it's not without an effect. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, and maybe not now is the time to talk about it, but I was just curious about what possible effect on weather and weather conditions harnessing so much wind may possibly have, and maybe the answer is none at all, but I'd be very curious.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest,
Senator Anderson.
I mean, kind of my fourth grade level answer to that would be, my gut answer basically would be, I mean, you'd have to have turbines sort of lined up like on every square foot of the state to really have that much impact, and that's never going to happen. and in countries and states that have the highest density of wind turbines, I don't believe this is an issue that has occurred, but we can let the technical people try to answer that. I've got better than I can. So if I may introduce the witnesses, maybe they can address that in their comments. Would that be all right?
Sure. I'm just curious.
Oh.
Senator Dipple, were you going to respond?
My guess, I mean, we'll listen to the official response, but I do think there is some consideration for how you place the wind turbines in relationship to each other, but I think overall I don't know that there's an effect, but I don't know. Maybe there is.
Yeah, they certainly have to be sited a certain distance from each other not to interfere, and there's also been progress over the years to make sure they're not sited in migratory flyways so you don't affect the patterns of migrating birds. But that's about the extent of my knowledge on that, so I'll let some of the other folks help you. But what I have is, let me just introduce, if I may. I've got from Windustry, Lisa Daniels and Paula McAbee representing Windustry on my right, and John Gostovich, who's representing Fresh Energy. Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union had to run over to the House, and hopefully he'll be back to do the cleanup because he's been a big supporter of this bill as well.
Okay.
So who wants to...
I can be real quick and brief.
Okay.
My name is John Gostovich. I'm an independent consultant. I've been working with Fresh Energy on developing strategies to accelerate the pace of wind development in the upper Midwest. And my background is in agricultural and resource economics. And the world under my feet shifted in terms of my work as a consultant when you all adopted the renewable energy standard for the state of Minnesota, because in one fell swoop, you all lit a fire under what's probably going to be the biggest rural economic development program in the history of this state between now and 2020, which is only 13 years. And when you get to be my age, 13 years goes pretty quick. But in the next 13 years, we're going to invest approximately $10 billion in rural Minnesota. And, you know, I think a real critical policy question is who benefits from that investment? And as you have heard even today, there's a tremendous amount of interest from counties, towns, farmers, rural bankers, entrepreneurs to have a piece of this wind development that is going to inevitably occur. And Senator Anderson's bill is not really a grant. It's not a giveaway. It's an investment in rural economic development. It's not technical assistance. It's not technical assistance. It's business development. Simply put, small institutions, individual farmers, small developers, entrepreneurs haven't been writing the contracts, doing the negotiation, doing the engineering studies, and putting together all the pieces to develop effectively and efficiently and economically utility-scale wind projects. And what Senator Anderson is talking about is a rural wind energy development company that can do the aggregation, that can support the negotiation, and can bring large, fully formed, sensible projects to the utilities who will be purchasing the power. And I think this is a proposition that's going to add value to all the players in the activity. And in fact, I think that this entity, once it gets rolling, will be able to become self-supporting by charging very, very small royalties on the power which it has helped bring to market. Again, we'll be paying for something very valuable. We'll let a whole range of institutions become players in a huge business. And I think, you know, when Minnesota looks at the ethanol development, when it adds on the wind development, these are significantly large enough piles of cash that it is of public interest who benefits and who pays. And I think that Senator Anderson's got an excellent bill. It's going to pay for itself, and it's really going to help community-scale wind developers.
Are there any questions of Mr. Gustavich? Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The nonprofit organization that would handle this, is there, I mean, do you have an idea of the construction of that organization, how it would develop, how many members would be involved, things like that? Have you thought that far out on this?
Well, actually, I spent the last couple of days trying to put together something like a business plan based on the language in this legislation. And the grant would be given to a nonprofit organization that has the experience and the capacity to run this sort of program, and that grant will be given out competitively. I imagine that the Rural Wind Development Corporation, because it's going to act more like a company than a nonprofit, I think, in the world, will probably have five or six permanent staff people. It will use legal, engineering, and technical consultants as necessary. It'll need some support staff. And it will be able to support probably half a dozen significant projects a year for the next 13 years. And if these are 20-megawatt projects, that will get community-scale wind development investment up to about $2.5 billion, or at least 25% of all the wind investment in the state. And the rest will be larger developers that do this day in and day out all over the world.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Daniels, were you prepared to respond to Senator Rest?
Yeah, sorry, I should have let her answer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to bring up, it's anecdotal data rather than really technical. I don't have a specific technical answer for Senator Rust, but I do have some information, I think, that can help. I would say that the wind turbines take a very small percentage of energy out of the wind And most of the wind still exists. They're not taking all of the wind out of the out of play for the weather system. You know, that's why there is a swept area. That's why the blades keep getting longer, is they only take the energy out of the wind where the blade is exists, where the swept area exists. So I would say in the scheme of things, climate change and global warming has a lot more impact on weather than a few wind turbines.
I wasn't asking that. I just wanted to know if there
Senator
was.
Senator Rest.
Yeah. In Europe, has there been an idea? And, you know, so I don't have a specific answer, but I could get the exact percentages for you if you were interested.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. The follow-up, I guess, on this, and this is just a thought that came up that maybe you can answer. I know there was a problem with one of these corporations or wind turbine sites that had to get approval from the Department of Defense, I believe, because of it was conflicting with radars or something. Is that going to be a problem in the future, do you know?
Yeah. Madam Chair. All of the projects right now, historically projects have had to get radar and FAA studies done, and that has been part of the process of getting a wind project sited and developed. As of last year, when that new additional study for radar and national security was added into Congress by Senator John Warner out of Virginia, it's one more process, one more study that has to occur before a wind project can be up and commercial. So radar studies happen for all the projects going forward. And I would say that they were stopped for all projects in progress when that bill went through Congress. All projects that were in progress were stopped. And because it was a national security issue, the lists of the project, there was no list or the geographic area was not defined about which projects were in were having troubles with actual radar systems. But most of the projects have all been addressed singly, one by one. And most of the times it's a small change, moving an individual wind turbine to a side to get it out of a sensitive area. But it is being addressed project by project.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. McAbee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving us a chance to testify. I think what Senator Anderson said is correct, that the legislature, by adopting the renewable energy standards, created a huge multi-billion-dollar business. And Minnesota needs to act, and I think we're looking for a number of other actions as well to make sure that community-based energy gets a share of that business. Because what we're seeing around the country, and there was a Wind Power Finance and Investment Summit in California in February 2007 reporting on trends, we're seeing around the country is a trend towards centralization and centralized control of wind resources. What we're seeing is smaller development companies are being bought up by larger ones. Some of the larger companies are even attempting to reserve wind rights out into the future without even requiring that, which would permit them to constrain the ability of local farmers to develop their own projects. So what we're working with, and we're hoping to work with, come back to this committee with some more policy guidelines to make sure that small local community-based interests, whether they're individual farmers or counties or small towns or schools, have an opportunity to be part of this new energy system. And some of the barriers to entry for a local farmer, the pre-development costs are hard to finance. Pre-development costs could be maybe $5,000 to $10,000 in terms of studies of wind conditions, issues like radar, and transmission studies to figure out what has to be done in order to connect a project, anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000. And this is non-collateralized. So one of the really important parts of Senator Anderson's bill is providing a revolving loan system through the Department of Commerce so that individuals who may not have collateral can demonstrate a likelihood of prevailing and that this money is needed and be able to move forward and do the pre-development studies. And we talked about this with Senator Anderson, the idea that a technical assistance, that I could both be helping you and reviewing your loan, was a problem. So as a good government, the technical assistance and the loan program were separated so that there could be a fair consideration of credit risks. Windustry doesn't really see this as an effort to try and make Community Wind competitive. On a cost basis, the cost of a power purchase agreement that's passed on to ratepayers, community energy is competitive right now. The problem is there's some barriers to entry in the market, and that what we're trying to do is not try and make Community Wind look like corporate wind, but try and remove the barriers to entry so that small, independent, whether it's farmers, whether it's a collective group of neighbors, whether it's a county, have an opportunity to generate the energy that we all can rely on, that's clean energy and restores the money back to the community. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
So this is real. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is really seed money for doing the initial development. I thought at first that, you know, $100,000 isn't going to go very far on a $1 million wind turbine. But so then with the expectation to be paid back in 6 months, so that's like once somebody gets the financing for the wind turbine, then the money would roll back into the revolving fund. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? I see Mr. Peterson has joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I'll just be very brief in my give you the Reader's Digest version here. I just believe there's a really strong need for this legislation. And I was had a conversation with Senator Anderson a few weeks ago as the RES was about to pass. And we were just talking about it kind of anecdotally. And I said, one of the things that's very exciting is I can't believe I'm getting about two or three calls a week from farmers that are getting involved in some kind of project or looking at a project. And that's quite a change. I've been with Farmers Union for many years, and I've never had that where they'll say, I'm doing a seabed project, or where our school's doing a project, or I'm putting up a project by myself, or I'm doing an LLC or a co-op. And a lot of times what happens with that is they say, I have a question about this. How do I do this? And I'm not an expert on wind energy, so where do I send them? You know, I send them to the Department of Commerce. I send them to Windustry sometimes, AORI. There's all kinds of places to send them, but I'm telling you that there's a need for that. And we also have worked with what's called Farmers Legal Action Group here in St. Paul to create a Farmer's Guide to Wind Energy. But that costs money, but that is in response because there are so many questions and people are excited about this. And I also think as I field some of these calls from our members that this type of legislation information also may help some projects not be built. And that's kind of weird too, but I always think that people are going to go forward, that there needs to be that too, that not every project's going to work. And that's important too as people are looking at investing their hard-earned money and some of these projects. So I just am here to say that I see a huge need for this, and it's an exciting time. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Anything further, Senator Anderson?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I want to add that, and I have a little technical amendment I need to make, but maybe I should do that first. We've asked the Institute for Renewable Energy and the Environment, which is known as IRE, at the University of Minnesota to be the pass-through organization that would put out the grant. And we need to, it needs to be the initiative. It's we said the institute. So on page 1, line 30, it should say, instead of institute, it should say initiative. And then on the next page, on 2.22, I think where it says commission, it should say initiative on renewable energy and the environment as well. But if council thinks that makes sense, that's what I'd like to move.
Is it 133 or 130?
Okay.
I said 2.22 and, 1.30.
And also on 2.29.
Okay. I'd add that. And yeah.
So Senator Anderson moves that on line 1.30, institute be changed to initiative. On line 2.22, commission be changed to initiative. And on 2.29, institute be changed to initiative. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, all I would add is, I think this is a really exciting idea. We think there's a big need for it to supplement some of the good work that's already going on with groups like Windustry and others. But we think the demand is just going to grow and grow across our state. And so this is the beginning of something I hope that will really provide a niche and a go-to place for a lot of people across Minnesota. The idea of it is to be self-sustaining. So we have an appropriation, but we want them to, whoever kicks this off, whoever runs this, to figure out how to raise the money ultimately. And so this is something we'll probably be looking at in the future. I've also was asked today, why can't we have Metro? Why can't we have people not in the rural Minnesota take advantage of this? You know, maybe our park would like to put up a wind turbine and could use some help. So I guess what I would say is stay tuned. This is the beginning of an idea that we're putting together, and I think it's sorely needed, and it will probably develop as time moves forward if it's successful, which we hope it will be.
Okay. So Senator Anderson moves 1244 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank
Motion
you.
Prevails.
Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of our meeting.
Okay. We need to reconvene this evening.